I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
It was a Friday evening in London. It was just past midsummer. It was the 22nd of June, after To the River, the trip to Echo Spring and the Lonely City, after Wolf, Alcohol, Loneliness and Art, Landscape and Psychology. There was Crudo. It was a brand new thing. Its writer had found a mode, a language and a form for now as well as then. It was so exciting. She'd written books about the lives of writers and the life of writing. This book was about, and simultaneously was an example of, the life in writing and the writing in life. It was red-hot poetry and neurosis. It was the fragility of bravado and the bravado of fragility. It was red-hot intelligence meeting what it called the centrifuge of history. And if the heroine of her first book, Virginia Woolf, was asking almost exactly 100 years ago, but what is reality? And who are the judges of reality? This book, Crudo, was and is today's answer to those questions in the novel form. Crudo takes what's been in her other books, her critical dialogue with other writers and artists, and turns it into an art form in itself. It is love story and rebellion against given form in one. It is a book so about dialogue with the makers of story, art, language, and the real that its protagonist exists in a full-flown aesthetic fusion, one that it's dangerous to split, and one which is pulling always centrifugally and centripetally towards splitting and away from creation and towards creation and destruction both, so that the novel becomes a critique of how we live in culture and how culture creates us as we create it. It is a whole new take and revelation on and shared experience of shared living, communal voice. It is a simultaneous kind of fracture and cohesion, and it's like each life is. It is sharp and blunt about our reality, from the personal atomic all the way to the master race Twitter fest that we're all being politically subjected to right now. It is a forceful book driving forward at a pitch that is unimaginable, but true, happening right now to us and round us. It's the written texture of the actual. It is completely contemporary. And now let's drop into some Shakespeare. Let's just visit for a moment that Make Me a Willow Cabin speech from Twelfth Night to introduce, to celebrate the brilliant first novel by Olivia.
We're done now, that's it.
Yeah. And she's going to read now, aren't you?
I'm going to read. This book, actually, I'm not going to read the bit, but there is a bit in this book about being at a reading in the LRB, so it feels quite strange to be at a reading in the LRB. Reading. Marriage in 5 days. Marriage in 4 days. Kathy peeled herself from her husband and boarded a train to London. She was feeling panicky. She couldn't quite remember how to be alone. Ironic, since she was the poster girl for female solitude. Itself ironic, since she barely regarded herself as female. A fag with tits. Statistically improbable, but not unheard of, especially in the conglomerate building internet era of gender dismantlement. The best thing about breast cancer was the double mastectomy. Lop them both off, she said. I always hated them. Hair cropped, skinny, flat-chested. She was a lovely, dickless boy, a wrinkling Dorian Gray, fondling her jewels. Who was the drag queen who'd kept a mummified corpse in her studio for years? Dorian Corey? No one Kathy actually liked had a stable gender identity. Not really. Transitioning, she loved the word, with its sense of constant emergence and zero arrival. She was indeterminate and oversexed, a hot chrysalis. If she had a dick, you better believe it would be perfect, at least as good as David Bowie's. I've been so looking forward to doing that line. At King's Cross, she took the Piccadilly to Holloway Road and walked north. She stopped at the Costa to buy mineral water and proceeded to an alley off Seven Sisters Road. The artist occupied a windowless studio. Her work was very pure and strange. She'd invented a new technique that allowed her to incorporate motion, assembling her sculptures precariously so that they toppled or burst or otherwise deviated from authorial design inside the kiln. The new pieces were kinetic and disturbing. They contained dangling entrails and slabs of bacon, hide, balls, a donkey's head, women's dainty ankles and bare Barbie doll feet, petals, guts, cloaks, and various internal organs. They weren't representational. Kathy just kept being reminded of things she'd seen, rendered deliciously in the coolness of porcelain. There wasn't any precedent. Maybe a garden that was simultaneously a mass grave would give you the right feeling, or some sort of body soup out of which a white world would shortly be created. They were that frightening, that generative and grossly pretty. The new ones had a component she hadn't seen before, which looked like the spine of a dead dolphin. Cathy wasn't being whimsical. She'd seen the spine of a dead dolphin, and this frighteningly ratcheted, tortured shape reminded her of it. Studio visit accomplished, PG tips drunk, Cathy went back to King's Cross and met Jenny in the pub. They talked about marriage, how to do it so it didn't bury you beneath all its baggage.
Yeah, marriage!
Oh, so indubitable.
They thought they had a handle on it. They thought they could see a way to maintaining their dignity, independence, autonomy, style, but it was touch and go, they both admitted. Place cards, stag do's, the whole thing was fucking repulsive. Someone somewhere had told her that day about hearing women say they were voting for Trump because they didn't want to work. I mean, Kathy said, three beers in, could we just fucking abolish not even gender, but people? I'm done. Home again, she went on Instagram, rich, naked and pallid in the ruined fallout shelters of Orford Ness. Somebody's courgettes arranged and lit like a Renaissance painting. Over the course of the morning, she'd become an expert on neo-Nazis. She knew about the Oath Keepers and the Three Presenters. She knew that cops were even crazier and more racist and evil than she thought, which, speaking as a cop watcher, Rodney King and Michael Stewart through to Philando Castile and Eric Garner, was maximally racist and unjust. It was late. She was up in her study listening to trains and a neighbour, or burglar, hauling sacks of compost in their garden. Red lights, white lights. How close to the state do you want to get? Do you care for the state? Does the state mean anything to you at all? Kathy was a libtard, regular schmuck. But she was also a biker bitch, a libertarian, live and let live. She didn't give a fuck. People could rip each other's faces off if that's what they wanted. Only, she really hated a racist cop with a gun. Strip him and drive him through the streets like wild pigs. Wouldn't that be the best thing to do? Outside, a man was shouting, "No power, no power," in a resigned voice. A new camaraderie. A green square like a meadow we can all be friends in. Kathy was tipsy and punchy. Kathy's hope is the hardest thing to hide.
Hmm. Okay. Two questions in tandem to start us off. First, how did you start to write this? Where did fiction suddenly come from out of your non-fiction? And also first, why Kathy Acker?
Oh, well, that's good, because those questions are the same answer. I've been trying for the last couple of years to write a book about bodies and embodiment and what it's like to live in a human body in the 21st century, with all of the many forces arranged against bodies, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't write it. And I realized that part of the reason was because you need some sort of a sense of a stable. I can see my publisher looking very tense at the back. I can do it, it's gonna be okay. You need some sort of stable platform. You need some sense that you've understood what's happening and that you can comment on it. And I couldn't find that. Everything was changing too fast. The levels of violence, the rise of the right, all of these things were just in flux. So I was very, very frustrated, and I was in Italy reading Chris Krause's amazing biography of Kathy Acker, and there was a bit in it about how Kathy would go into a library, pick up a biography of Toulouse-Lautrec or a book of Dickens, and she'd just turn it into the first person. And something about that just made me feel excited, and I thought, well, what happens if I just plagiarise my life, steal my life, put it in the Kathy Acker person and just see what happens in terms of writing down what's going on. And as soon as I started, as soon as I wrote the first sentence, I realised that I'd found a form that allowed me to, you see it in that reading, capture that sort of thing of the movement between an internal world and a terrifying, rapidly shifting external world. So that was the beginning.
So what was that like then, dealing with the pull between first and third? I mean, or did it feel utterly liberating to be able to do both?
Completely liberating. I mean, there's first person on the first page, and then the first person is ditched, and there is this Kathy character, but really everything that happens to her either happened to Kathy Acker or it happened to me. There's a fusion of that.
So Acker because she embeds?
Acker because she's a thief. Acker because she's somebody Great. Who... Yeah. Acker because... Yeah. We have this funny idea of Kathy Acker right now. We have this idea of her as this sort of woman with piercings and tattoos who wore Vivienne Westwood. And that's sort of stuck in people's minds. And actually, Kathy Acker should be remembered and maybe is starting to be remembered for her extraordinary writing, which speaks like almost no one else I can think of to the present moment. It's about abortion, it's about terrorists, it's about the far right, it's about all of these things that 5 years ago felt like they were the past, they were the 80s, and now they feel like they are smacking you in the face every morning.
Okay, so what the book does with that kind of bringing together of all the possible selves via the self, via the culture that the self was imbibed, as it were, is it reminds me of when you're talking about Vojnarovic in The Lonely City, who wears the Rambo mask. And then I found this fantastic, that moment where Rambo says, je est un autre, I am an other, I am the.
I is the other. Yeah.
Talk to me about how mask is working then in this.
Yeah. The Rambo analogy is so, my friend Chantal Duffy, the painter, is here, and we've been talking so much about this book, the construction of this book, and about Vojnarovic.
And is this a masked time?
It's a time where people have all sorts of false identities. And what David did with that project was he brought Rambo into his own life. He made the Rambo story part of the Lower East Side in the 70s. He took him to the meatpacking district. He went cruising. But it was with this Rambo, he took the myth on. And it seemed to me like, what would happen if you took Kathy Acker into the 21st century? What would she make of things? What would she think about it? And how much does her writing answer back to this moment? So whenever this character Kathy is writing, it's always Acker's writing.
Yeah.
And that, just bringing those words into now, felt electrifying. I mean, I don't know whether she would have approved the project or not, but I felt like there was a sense in which her writing was just longing for this moment.
But then one of the things that the book asks is what reality and identity are anyway. Is there a real Kathy Acker? Is there a real Olivia Lang?
There's just layers and layers and layers. There's multiple different masks that you wear in different situations. And there's this crazy division we have between the personal and the political, as if they're separate worlds.
Good.
And they... I'm having a supervision.
For instance, the epigraph of this book: the cheap 12-inch square marble tiles behind speaker at UN always bothered me. I will replace with beautiful large marble slabs if they ask me. Talk about the political styling, as it were.
That's a completely unattributed tweet from Donald Trump before he became president. I mean, that is bananas, right?
Perfect.
I wanted everyone's voices. I'll just say something about how I wrote this book. So I had two rules. I wasn't allowed to edit or even reread, and I had to write at least once a day, and actually often it was three times a day. I mean, I don't know how
Why
you
Why did
guys,
you have the rules?
I was playing. It was a game that I was playing, it came with some rules. I think because it was like Kathy Acker in the 70s writing according to rules, and it felt exciting to me to have some rules.
The ball game of language.
The ball game of language, the exchange of language. Yeah. So, I was writing down everything that came my way. Everything that happened went in. So if Trump tweeted something about the troops or nuclear war, it went in his own words. Nothing's in quote marks. It's all just as the now pours onto you day by day. And I just wanted to write down what it feels like to be drenched under it.
To be now, to be at this point where things move so fast and so febrilely.
And you're breaking under it. So the sense of a stable identity, the idea that there might be a stable individual in a realist novel about this moment is absurd to me. Good. Of course the eye is cracking up and fracturing.
The remaking of the novel.
Yeah. And we're inventing ourselves all the time on Twitter, on Instagram. We're creating these curated selves.
So I see that, in that I see a kind of a lineage that comes, and I don't even know if you'll think these people are lineage, but from right back at the beginning of the 20th century, Charlotte Mew, the poet, who wrote the line, "His hands are full of broken things." Mm. I mean, her poetry is a kind of force of pace, which, and I recognise in Credo, there's something about the points of the coming into the new century, which are passed through both books. And Mansfield, Catherine Mansfield, who's all about performance, and Isherwood, and Plath, and Acker. These seem to me to be...
And Wolf, definitely. Wolf. I mean, this is Wolf's project. I feel like all we can do in some ways is just sort of shuffle after Wolf, trying to continue little tiny aspects of her great project. And a lot of that is about how do you get what it's like to live in the present? And it's so ironic that she's a writer who's always thought about in terms of her end as if she's travelling towards this tragic end, whereas she's somebody who is continually trying to work out a way of writing about what it's like to live right now with the future ahead of you, but no sense of what that's going to be, this openness around you, dragging the past behind you like tin cans.
It's a risk, as you know, the quote, it's a risk that you take with the form of the novel to do that. But the force of it, the core of it, is utter generosity, because in the assimilation of all the things we've been talking about, including the realities and the writers all as one thing, you open, by your writing, and by extension all writing, everything that's written to open source. And the shared self, if you like, the question of how we cohabit, is at the core of this book.
Yeah. The idea of just how you... Kathy's struggling with the idea of intimacy and the idea of commitment, but that seems to me... This is what I mean about the personal and political not being separate. We see that as a personal question, and we see a world of hyperviolence as a political question. We see concentration camps for children as a political question. But actually, the two are constantly enmeshed. How we live, how we're capable of dealing with conflict, how we're capable of dealing with care, all of these different things are how we make the political world that we live in. It's us that make it. And our small changes also change it.
And yet, do you think this book could have been written without Trump?
No. No, absolutely not. No, there's something about the level of horror that I felt like I and everyone I knew had fallen into. I mean, Brexit was a beginning of it, but there's something about the grotesqueness of Trump, the voice of Trump. There's so many of his tweets sort of woven into it.
I have a feeling we have Trump and Putin to thank, you know, all their theatricality to thank for this book.
I don't think it's good enough.
She missed the sense of time as something... No, listen. She missed the sense of time as something serious and diminishing. She didn't like living in the permanent presence of the id. I mean, it says it in a way.
And the next line is, she missed Obama. Everyone missed Obama.
She missed Obama. Everyone missed Obama. that way, the novel becomes, in a way, id and ego and superego, because it becomes the critique that we need to be able to articulate where we are and what is happening.
And this is a character who's an egotist and a narcissist and is incredibly selfish and self-absorbed, and about one person learning how to open up in the midst of a society that's getting more and more closed and controlled and regulating its borders and policing its borders. It's about trying to do the opposite.
But it's also really largely about the shift between feeling and numbness from not just the news feed, but the ways in which we are feeding ourselves with all information now.
Yeah.
There's this quote, there's a beautiful thing you say, Kathy was becoming obsessed with the numbness, the way the news cycle was making her incapable of action. No one could put anything together. That was the problem. That recurs, that notion of the not being able to connect, the disconnect.
Yeah.
That's technological. Is it technological, the disconnect? Is that?
I don't think it's just technological, because I was reading Philip Guston, the painter Philip Guston, was talking about the same thing in the 60s, and he was saying he'd been reading Holocaust testimony, and he was sort of fascinated and horrified by the way that everything the Nazis did was designed to make people numb, to make people feel helpless, and as if they didn't have any agency. Mm. And then he talks about the people who'd escaped from camps and what they'd had to do to unnumb themselves. And then at the end of this statement, he says, that's the job of an artist, it's to make you unnumb. And that just felt to me like, we writers can't change the political situation, but there is something we can do in terms of engaging with us, the people. Okay.
At which point, this novel is really all about what a novel is for. I mean, that to me, before we start to talk about, you know, what a novel might be for, what was it like to start to write fiction after non-fiction? Did it feel different? What happens formally in your head when that happens? What's the thing, practically the physical thing that happens when you shift from one form to another?
It was the most liberating, ecstatic writing experience I've ever had. And I know I won't have that experience again, because the way I write non-fiction is obsessive. It takes a very long time. It's very research heavy. I'm in archives a lot, but also I write and rewrite every sentence 200 times, and it's agonizing. I mean, I hate it. I hate the process. So being able to make this rule that I didn't look back at sentences meant I could move so much faster. There was, you know, I always said I'd never write fiction because I didn't see a need to, and I was wrong. Like, there was no way that I could have recorded what this moment felt like with nonfiction, because it would have
pretended towards
some sort of capacity of understanding and commenting, some sort of idea that there was a sense, and there isn't. It's senseless what's happening at the moment. It's not possible to talk about in nonfiction. Perhaps it will be in a decade, but right now it's not.
Why? What is it? What is the special quality of fiction that means that's why we and how we can talk about it?
I think something about being able to do things simultaneously, to be able to have multiple threads going on at once, something about having a single person's, a character's voice telling the story, allows you to do something that you can't if you have this sort of the non-fiction narrator telling you in this calm, stately way what's happening. There isn't a calm, stately way to talk about now.
Does that make the novel a kind of multiple? Like,
yes.
A Warhol multiple?
Yes, yes. Yeah? Yeah, like a sort of stamping of different versions of the reality.
But then the novel itself refers to itself throughout. It kind of begs the deeply novelistic question of likable characters. So this repeats throughout it. So, you know, was Kathy nice? It says practically it says in the first page, doesn't it? And then later on, page 85, it's saying, it's looking like probably no. Followed by, on page 86, who gave a fuck, Kathy thought. No one liked Putin. Likeability was irrelevant. What mattered was whether you could make people numb enough to change all the laws, change the entire system. Yeah?
We're in a funny moment with likeability, aren't we? Because social media has made us addicted to being liked. I mean, literally liked. We all want these likes.
There we
gather up these likes.
Yeah.
And at the same time, people who are profoundly dislikable are running the country. People who are profoundly dislikable are running America. There's this sort of odd tension, and I don't even know what to sort of say about that or how to speculate about that. I just feel like that's an energy that's going on at the moment. That's something that is intriguing to me.
Why? Come on. Kind of open that.
Because why do you want to be liked? Why do you want to be liked by other people when it's not what's needed right now? It isn't what we need to be doing. We need to be thinking much more in a communal way, in a collective way. I think it's something about that.
Yeah.
It's something about, no, it's not just that. It's about difference as well. I think that there's a real problem at the moment, which is not accepting other people's difference, not allowing people to be different from each other, finding it absolutely threatening for people to have different opinions, different takes, different languages. And the idea of trying to be likable seems to sort of thread into that it's something about not wanting to be threatening at a moment where I think we do need to make much more allegiances and tolerate difference much more strongly.
I know, the notion that I can only like this story if there's something in it that is like me and that I like.
Likeness. Yeah, wanting things to be the same. Mm. Bullshit.
Mm.
I mean, what do you want
more than bullshit.
Want difference, if you don't want to be introduced to the idea that other people are different from you, that seems to me the point of the novel, certainly, but other art forms too.
Other art forms too. So, that's tell us why this novel hangs about the other art forms, because it does. That's its club.
Yeah, it's right lurker.
Yeah, go on. It does. It hangs about. Like, for instance, that's Rachel Newbone, the artist that you're describing in the piece you read to us.
It's full of artists. It's some artists in it are named and some artists in it aren't named. But I suppose partly because I'm still so, from Hangover from the Lonely City, that was the moment where I became completely fascinated by visual art and using visual art as a way to think into places that we're resistant to language, we're resistant to being talked about. I feel like there's such a danger with language at the moment that things become glib, things become easy to say, things become boiled down and thrown back in your face. There's this idea that people are constantly being challenged by statements that they made a long time ago. That sort of Twitter thing that goes on and on. There's something about art that lets you express without getting into that. It gets past that. And that's what feels very exciting to me, that there's a way of expressing emotional states or expressing political longings by way of something visual. Also, I just really like looking at pictures.
And it asks the question of why anyone produces anything as well, this novel. It does ask about creativity at its core, and it asks about why we would ever produce anything that took the form of art. At one point, Kathy is in such a state, she says, "There is no story," she writes. "I'm going crazy, it's just a cry." But there is a story.
Which actually, that was a quote from Kathy Acker, which I could not find, so I couldn't source it, and then I found it the other day, but now it's too late, so the estate will probably sue me for that line. It's not my line. But there is, and you find this sense in her all the time as well. She's somebody, I feel like I haven't done justice to Kathy in this, the real Kathy. She's somebody who's always writing at the pitch of senselessness. She's always writing things that are terrified of and longing for toppling over the edge into senselessness, this sort of abyss of not being understood, which is part of what I find so sort of alluring about her writing. So that, I'm going crazy, it's a cry, I feel like that's something that is the artist's sort of terror. I can't describe this, this is beyond description. And it's a terror I certainly feel, and I think a lot of people feel about this moment. What's the point of art in a moment like this? What's the point of doing anything? And at the same time, what kind of world do we want? And is it a world with art in it? And if so, then got to keep making it, it's got to still be there. It's a very complicated sort of ethical position to inhabit. Why do we make art, Ali?
Tell me.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
But in a way, is this novel's revolution.
I mean, I keep saying this book is a love story, and it is. It's like a very, very political love story. About being in despair and deciding that it's still worth trying. It's about thinking, as I very much did in September last year, that we were going to be annihilated in nuclear war, and it's still worth loving somebody, it's still worth writing something down, it's still worth making a story up in the hope that, I mean, that's that, not to be a downer, but like that's as good as it gets in some ways. It is always in the hope that you touch somebody, in the hope that you change something. I've been reading the new Sally Rooney book, which is coming out in September, and you all must absolutely buy. And she says this amazing thing in it, which I'm still really struck by. There's a young character in her 20s, and she's talking about when I was a year or so younger, I thought I could save everyone in the world. I thought I was so brilliant, I was so clever, I'd be able to solve these problems. And now I see that actually perhaps one or two people's lives would be marginally improved by my existence. And she's very depressed by that, but at the same time, it seems like actually one or two people's lives slightly better because of your existence. Great, that's amazing. That's, again, that's as good as it gets.
I'm going to ask you some of Kathy's questions now, because this book is full of questions, so I'm just going to ask them to you. Human relations, how?
Tonight? Why are you looking at me? Human relations, how? I mean, they're just so difficult. And a lot of this, like, you know, I'd written a book about loneliness. I'd been alone for a very long time, and then I was in a relationship and getting married. And those were my questions, like, how? How do you stay kind? How do you not lose your shit all the time? How are you chill when you are a really unchill person? All of those things seemed like, you know, they're live questions to me. Perhaps everyone else has that sort of stuff locked down, but I really didn't. And it felt sort of good to unpack that as well. That it's all very well talking about melancholy or shame or these emotions that are actually in some ways easier to talk about. But selfishness seems really interesting to me in this selfish age. Actually unpacking what it's like to be a very selfish person. It's a little bit embarrassing, but also seems like it's worth mapping.
Yeah. Okay. Number two. What's the novel about if not getting fucked?
Nothing. That is what the novel's about.
Is it what the novel's about?
In one way or the other.
And
yes,
you see,
that made me terribly
excited because of the act of embedding that is all the way through this, which meant that an embedding of text is a kind of erotic act.
Yeah, 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 totally. Yeah. It's a sensual act. Yeah. And it's a generative act. It makes something happen.
Okay, the last of these questions. I mean, what is art if it's not plagiarising the world?
I just think that's what it is. Yeah. I do think that's what it is. I mean, what are we doing? Whatever kind of fiction you're writing, in some way you're trying to create a replica of what the world felt like, what the world
feels,
smelt like, yes. how it is to inhabit it. Yes. Even if you're writing sci-fi, even if you're Margaret Atwood, there's still some sense of trying to get, this is what it's like to be on this little planet for this brief period.
Right now. Okay, I'm going to wind up with one or two things and then I'm going to open it to the floor, okay? That phrase of yours, the whole green simultaneity of life, I mean, that's a phrase I wish I'd written. I'm just going to take it and embed it in my next novel, as if I did. And I'm hoping your publishers won't give me a hassle.
Again, he's looking tense.
quote, she wanted to write another book, obviously, and she wanted to find a way of situating it nowhere. How's that going?
Fucking awful. But it's true. It's true. This is the body book. And, I mean, that is something that, it's so hard to articulate what I'm talking about until I finish this book. I hate talking about it.
Okay.
But there's some way in which I don't want it to be tied to a moment. I don't want it to seem like it's a story about Berlin in 1939. I don't want it to seem like it's a story about Britain in 2017. not Credo, this is everybody, the other book. I want to find some way in which it's about questions that are ongoing.
Although, but the interesting thing about Crudo to me is that it's full of medievalism. Mm. I mean, we kind of don't expect it. Suddenly it'll just drop into your scrying the scrying glass, which is Twitter.
Yeah.
Or it'll drop into listening. She hears voices. Kathy hears voices. And the voices she hears are actually voices of people around her, but she's still hearing voices. It's still something about the medieval saint in that. It crosses time.
And that she's walled in. She's got that sort of anchorite walled in thing, and then she has to smash her way out of it. Mm.
Okay, this beautiful thing, this throwaway phrase, this book full of beautiful throwaway phrases about which people could write each, you know, a different thesis, I think, about each. Power and ice, their similarities. The colder we are, the more powerful.
The colder we are, but also that power just drains away. We have these powerful, powerful people, we have these powerful eras, and then they just fall away. There's some sense of wanting a long view in this book as well, that it's very caught up with the moment, but it's also aware that we're in a Roman Empire, or we're in Berlin before the Nazis arrive. We're in these moments, and
what happens has absolute reality, and at the same time it's a speck of dust. It just turns into something else. On and on it goes. Mm. So ice turns into water, yeah, and turns back into ice. On we go.
Mm. The uncool coolness of this book's risk-taking. It's brilliant. And this is my last question, and it comes from one of your phrases, and we've been talking about it, but I just want to end at least my part of this with this quote from you from the book. That's the only reason to be an artist, to escape, to bear witness to this. What is the reason?
That's the Philip Guston bit that I was talking about earlier, and I think that is the reason. I think that is the only reason. I mean, to escape, to get out of the camps, to get out of the prison of the moment, and the prison of selfishness, all of these prisons that we're in. This book is so much inspired by Christopher Isherwood's Goodbye to Berlin, which in some ways is like Christopher Isherwood having sex in the Kit Kat Club, and in other ways is about a descent into hell and how that happens and how individual people deal with that, who gives into it, who collaborates, who chooses to resist, how those people make those decisions are based in their personal lives. And there are ways out. There are always ways out. There's always a gap in the fence. You can choose to be the person that mans the borders, or you can choose to be the person with the wire cutters. It's up to you.
Questions from the audience, please.
You write about visual art in your non-fiction with this kind of beautiful lightness that feels already a lot like fiction or poetry. And I was wondering if when you sort of set out to write fiction with that intention, whether you felt like you were engaging with visual art in a different way at all, or if it was sort of an similar experience.
I think it came from the same impulse, but I just felt much, much freer. You know, in Lonely City, it was still in some ways, there's a scholarliness to it that I wanted to sort of say what the sources were and where I was seeing things and to have some sort of solid critical view to it. Whereas with this, because it was from the perspective of this person who's so extreme, it let me really romp around what I felt things looked like or felt like or what angered me or what made me excited. So I had much, much more liberty. And I notice now when I'm writing reviews or when I'm writing stuff that, again, has that sort of critical voice, that it's definitely loosened some joints got broken and have stayed, like, looser, which I think is a good thing. I don't know. We'll see.
I think what I found really interesting keeping up with you writing this book is exactly what you've been talking about, which is this freedom of accepting the kind of dominance of narrative. And something that I found really interesting in reading a bit more philosophy in the last couple of years has been, of all the kind of theories of essentialism for humans, is the idea that the human is the narrative animal. Mm. And I think if I was to question anything, it's like whether you think that realizing that accepting that narrative is everything is going to allow you to write more freely in a non-fiction capacity.
Good question.
Because actually, if you think of how you wrote The Lonely City, you were still finding a narrative thread that could be challenged in lots of ways, because a lot of it was your narrative thread.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, in some ways that was not a move into fiction, but into just, this is the way that I want to assemble this story. These are the people that I'm interested in. You know, what do they all have to do with each other? Warhol and Wonarovich and Edward Hopper, just some sort of tracking that I could see and then try to lay down so that other people could follow. But it was really a sort of breadcrumb path through the forest. Like that was a risk. And this is very much more of that element. But I feel like with a narrative animal, but we tell so many stories and our stories contradict and our stories get into wars with each other. And there's something about having that fluidity. I mean, Ali is the true queen of that, of being able to jump stories, jump into a different story, change your story, let your story transform you, that we don't have to have one set of stories.
That's really interesting, precisely because of the ways in which Lonely City trekked an autobiographical thing which opened, and so does Crudo. I mean, I'm loath to use the notion of autobiography anywhere near it, although we know that there's something of your life in this. But it doesn't matter, does it? It's irrelevant.
No, it's totally irrelevant.
The single life
could
has become
be
irrelevant.
Could be anyone's life. It was just that I
fiction
happened to have more...
Fiction frees the self.
Fiction frees the self. Yeah. And the autobiographical element is just like it's material, it's useful data on what a human life in 2017 was like and what t-shirt you might have worn and what tube line you might travel on. I mean, why make that up? I had it, I'd done it, so why not just use that? I had other things to do, like that wasn't, why making it up wasn't.
Why would we expect the novel not to be the reality?
So, sort of going on from that, like I was at a book event the other day and I was talking about reading Crudo, and the person I was talking to asked me, like, because I was talking about how an element of it is the marriage, and so the person asked me, like, oh, so is Olivia Lane straight? And I said, well, that's not really the question that, I don't know, that should be asked, or at least it's certainly not the most interesting question. And so, like, as you publish more and you include so much of your life in your own fiction, nonfiction, like, do you find it challenging as you become a more public figure that people want to define public figures and put them in boxes and define them in certain ways? And like, so how do you sort of combat that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, I really hate that. And I think especially, you know, this is something I'm comfortable about talking about in this room, but not in all rooms where I get asked these questions. Like, my gender identity is trans. So, yeah, I married a man. Like, what's the surprise there? It's not straight. But it looks straight. So I think there are rooms that I walk into where assumptions are made about my gender that aren't the case. And that makes me feel really uncomfortable and really uneasy. What can you do? Keep pushing away, I suppose. But generally, like, I think if you use material from your own life, then you're going to get people writing about it in The Standard and saying what kind of china you eat your breakfast off, and that seems like point missing, but also that's just what the world's like, so I guess you need to be thick-skinned.
How do you reconcile with what we say about differences and people having these differences and all the kind of battles on Twitter with the really bad people? How do we reconcile that with the people who are doing evil things and they're over there and we're here? How do we join up? How do we unify people?
That's so essential. That feels so essential that we're kind of constantly lost in these battles that in some ways are vital about how we use language and microaggressions and all of these things that are really important. But at the same time, there has to be some base tolerance of people having different opinions and being able to have solidarity. I just feel like solidarity is the most important concept in the world, because it isn't about everyone thinking the same thing. It's about people from different struggles making
now
common
ground. The base thing of, like, is it bad to put children in a camp has changed, because that's not
the Overton window.
Other people don't think that's bad now.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah.
So when those things happen, it's like,
No. Just because people have done it doesn't make it not bad. That's the next step we have to make. Yeah. That's the point at which media is failing us right now.
Yeah. And that's the problem with media, because it does just say this has happened. It immediately makes it legitimate. And then it says, oh, well, let's have one of those incel guys on to talk about what they think. Women should be in rape camps. Oh, well, now let's have an op-ed about that. It's fucking crazy.
It fills the space. That's the problem. It fills the space.
And the media is set up to, not to be against the media because I'm part of it, but it is set up in a way that actually has turned out to be quite problematic, in that it's always trying to have the other side, and the other side has got so incredibly extreme. Yeah. That's a problem. I don't know the answer to that, but I think we will come to an answer because we have to.
Just to encourage you to lurk around the other arts, can you talk about the cover? It's such a beautiful cover, but it's also really its resonance might not be immediately obvious, so that would be interesting to.
So there's a scene in the book which has become sort of very key to me of Cassie eating a crab and smashing it with a hammer, smashing it open, and then continuing sort of throughout the book reflecting on this idea of wanting to be opened, wanting to undo her boundaries, to be more available to people, to be more available to love, I suppose. So I had this crab thing going on in my head, and this is this amazingly beautiful picture is by Wolfgang Tillmans, and
hold up.
It's so, like, the colours are beautiful. It's got this sort of Memento Mori thing going on with the fly and the way of all flesh Catholic stuff, which I kind of like as well. And I decided I wanted it, so I wrote to his gallerist and said, what do you think? And she'd really liked the Lonely City, so she said, well, here's Wolfgang's email address. And Wolfgang wrote back and said,
It sounds right up my Strasse.
Which I now say about everything all the time.
Hi. Sorry, it's not really a fully formed question, but I like asking questions. Oh, into it. Hi. So I know that your previous book, I haven't read this book, by the way, but I know that they're very generous towards visual art, but how much do you think it works the other way, like the visual arts into literary? And that's very much no, but I don't know. Like, to what extent do you think visual art at the moment is commenting on what's going on in the literary world? So I think, you know, it's sometimes been two-way, but at the moment I don't see that.
That's really interesting. I mean, one of the, there's lots of people whose conversations really inform this book, but one of them is my friend Chantal Duffy, who's over there, who's a painter and fascinated by literary figures, fascinated by writers, and the sort of intensity of the conversations, I sit for her quite a lot, and the intensity of the conversations we have from discipline to discipline felt like it really informed what I was doing in this book. So I can't answer for all artists, but I certainly feel like there are artists who are quite excited by what... Because it feels like we're in a really good moment for literature, like exciting cross-genre stuff is happening in books all over the place. There's amazing things going on. And so I'm glad that that sort of sense of crackling is, you know, artists are interested by it, drawn to it as well.
Just an extension of that question. I mean, would you or have you considered working in a more kind of closely collaborative way with visual artists in your own work?
Sarah Wood and I, the filmmaker Sarah Wood and I, are in fact collaborating at the moment on a show about Orlando, installation and show about Orlando, which is going to be at Charleston Festival in September. So yeah, I mean, I do regularly collaborate with visual artists, and it's the thing that I most like doing. I find it really exciting. There's something about jumping over the gap between disciplines that I always find really exciting. That sort of illicit reaching feels very exciting to me. Yeah.
That's the place where it all happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it seems like a lot of your work and life is constantly kind of coming up and trying to smash taboos. And a lot of Crudos is kind of the horror at some of the taboos that maybe should be taboos breaking down. So yeah. Is there a future for taboos?
Wow. What do you think?
Well, it's up to you. You're answering this one, not me.
Is there a future for taboos? I mean, yeah, I feel like it should be taboo to put a child in a cage. Yeah. I mean, what do you guys think?
Well, it is. Yeah. It is taboo to put a child in a cage. It's the child catcher. It's myth. It's Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Trump knows exactly what he's doing. It's all theatre.
Yeah.
It's all a theatre of horror.
It's
a theatre
enacted on people's bodies, though, on vulnerable bodies.
On real people, really, cruelly happening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that it's not ending. It's not ending at all. It's families in indefinite detention. It's not ending. So, yes, I think there is a future for taboos. And I think there are taboos that limit people's freedoms. There are prejudices that limit people's freedoms, and then there are other taboos that are there to ensure all of our freedoms. And I feel like one kind is better than the other. Does this really need saying? And yet it does need saying, because we all seem to have, not us in this room necessarily, but communally as a people currently, we seem to have forgotten that.
Okay, well, I have two, because I've got a cheeky one and one to that. Do you think Kathy Acker would think there should be an end to taboos? I mean, would she get rid of them? And I also want to ask, if Kathy Acker was redesigning the United Nations, or Kathy, maybe I should say, is redesigning the United Nations, what would she do with those tiles behind them?
Oh, God, I mean, I think in some ways Kathy Acker would find me so unbearably earnest. Like, she, you know, oh, I want the world to be better. She'd be like, oh, for fuck's sake, it's not going to be. Get used to it. But I also think, like, her rooms are like those sort of theatre of horrors, that she creates these scenarios and puts herself, her whatever her character is, her Don Quixote character or her Pip character, you know, all of these different people, she puts them through this mill. Almost like Desaad does, what happens? When do they, are they destroyed? Do they survive? And often they do survive. Often they're like these hardened little kernels that come out at the end. And I feel like that actually, there is an earnest question going on at the heart of Acca that is about, what is the meaning of pain? Do we have meaning? Do our lives have meaning? Perhaps not, and then at the end, well, perhaps they do. God knows what she'd do with the United Nations. I don't imagine her going into the United Nations. It doesn't seem like very ACCA territory.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Hi. So the idea of, like,
living with a lot of voices in your head, and that being something that's kind of particularly potent within our moment, and simultaneously the idea that in intimacy and in personal relationships, you can kind of maybe triumph over that because that it's more specific to the relation between two people. That kind of seems to, that idea again of like difference being embraced and celebrated. Do you think that there is some trouble in the fact that that message just sounds like trite, like love is the answer. It sounds trite, like however much it is true, the fact that it's like associated with like being an easy answer, an easy message, is in itself problematic. And that's why like when you're discussing on the news, children being torn apart from their families, it feels like so distant from that, from a conversation about love, from a conversation about like what it means to be a human. I don't know, like does it not feel a bit like a struggle to end on the message like love is the answer, love is trite, when you know that that answer is out there, we just don't access it or make it feel like potent enough as often as we should.
I also think it's really, really hard. Like part of the project of Crudo is trying to just set down how hard, it's so glib to say love, but actually it's really, really difficult. It's really difficult to not be selfish. It's really difficult to care for another person. It's really difficult to take another person in, let alone people who are strangers who you don't know. Those sort of acts of generosity, I think maybe the word generosity just sounds like it's this sort of easy, available thing. And so I wanted to look at somebody who was ungenerous, who was unloving, and see what it meant for them to just inch towards being slightly kinder. Because I think you're right, it sounds so drippy, and actually it's like, it's labour, it's work, it's effort, it's creativity. To be loving is an act of constant sort of ingenuity. Because everything's sort of arranged against it, including our massive egos.
I don't think it's maybe cheeky and fun enough to be the last one, but I was just wondering about empathy, which seems, alongside solidarity, the other thing that maybe we need to hang on to. And I was wondering about the writers in the trip for Echo Spring versus Kathy Acker, and whether, I've not read Crudo yet, but it feels like with the trip to Echo Spring, you kind of almost happened upon a certain level of empathy with the writers that you set about writing about. And I wondered to what extent that was what happened with Kathy, or whether Crudo began with that sense of empathy, if that makes sense.
That's really interesting, because I think Echo Spring was so much looking at how damage reproduces, why are people damaged, like what are the forces that cause people to be damaged, which is sort of the question of the Lonely City as well. And talking about these external forces so we can be empathic about the suffering person. And Crudo is sort of different because it's more like, well, how do you create your own reality? How do you choose these things? And we do both. Like, let me make it very clear that we don't choose all of our own suffering at all by any means. Lots of it comes from external reasons. But there's some element as well in which we do have agency and we do create worlds that we inhabit. And it felt exciting to me to sort of change frame and to look at that in a moment where we can so easily feel powerless. What can we feel powerful about? And what are ways that we can unpick those tendencies towards hatred, aggression in ourselves, in small ways, but also in larger ways? So I think there's some mirror images and acceptance. Yeah, and these words are so awful, acceptance, love, generosity. I mean, they're
those are great words.
But they're great words. But they're used in such a sloppy way, as if they're just there. And they're not. They're this sort of effortful, exciting thing. And I think if we think of them as this exciting project, it's so different.
Is that where we're going to end? We're from the ingenuity of love, to the ingenuity of Crudo. I want you to thank the gods for the ingenuity of Olivia Lang.
Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.